is Seattle Sports.
Streaming through the Seattle Sports app.
KIRO AM Seattle. KIRO FM HD2 Tacoma.
This hour is brought to you by the Harnish Auto family.
Get in the freaking auto!
This is Brock and Salk.
I don't read the internet, guys.
Take the bull by the hands.
On Seattle Sports.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
And Brooke Wire, you are. And Brooke, you are.
Styled by Simply Seattle.
Now here are your hosts, Brock Heward and Mike Salk.
Let the fire!
Oh, man, it is the Brock and Salk Show. Seattle Sports 710, SeattleSports.com, Seattle Sports app, podcast platforms, all of it, wherever you may be, will find you. What a night at the ballpark. God, I love baseball. I really do. And I know there's folks that might be frustrated by a game like that one. I loved it. I really, really enjoyed that game last night. Two pitchers absolutely getting after it. Is the Mariners lineup problematic at times? Yes. Did they strike out a whole bunch yesterday and give up an opportunity to win the game in the eighth? They sure did. Was their pitching electric? Oh, my God, was it ever? And had Mitch Garver not come through in the ninth inning the way he did with a two-run bomb to walk off winners, I would have come in here and you know what I would have talked about? Defense. I know it would have driven you crazy. I'm sure it would have. I'm sure there's some folks who would have been just throwing things at the radio because it's offense, 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 offense. But the reason, in my view, that the Mariners were in position to lose that game yesterday had nothing to do with offense. It had everything to do with defense. It had to do with two plays that were unfortunately both went against them. It's the seventh inning, the first hit of the game as Bryce Miller was completely dominating an unbelievably good, maybe best lineup in baseball from Atlanta. And Dylan Moore filling in at short, can't get himself in front of a ground ball that was a makeable play. It's a hit. It's not an error.
Yeah.
That's a makeable play. And I would say in the modern game, if there are 30 starting shortstops in the game, 26, 28 of them probably make that play. And unfortunately, he couldn't. That run goes on to score after Miller gives up the double. And there's your one run. Eighth inning. Couple of innings later, you got an opportunity to win the game or at least go ahead in the game and turn it over to your closer. You're just trying to tie it up. You got men on first and second, Luke Raley up, and he does this.
The 1-2 pitch to Raley, swinging a ground ball right side. Diving is the second baseman, Albies. He got it, knocks it down, but can't get off the throw.
So Raley's safe at first. But instead of the ball going into the outfield and scoring the runner from second base, now you got bases loaded, one out. As you know, Julio pops up and then a strikeout and that's it. And everyone's very, very upset and the Mariners can't get it done. And I totally get that that's how it looks in that moment. But they do their job. Not just Bryce Miller, but one of my favorites, Cody Bolton. By the way, if you're looking for the next Justin Topa, in my view, it's Cody Bolton.
Ooh, good call.
Very similar stuff. Been saying it for a couple of weeks now. Every time I watch him, I just see Justin Topa. Topa's stuff might be a little bit better, so I'm not saying they're the same, but man, he is very similar with the stuff, the way he manipulates the baseball, etc. He gets it done in the eighth. Austin Voth gets it done in the ninth. Polanco singles, and guess what Mitch Garver does?
The stretch by Minter. Polanco a lead, and the lefties 3-2 on the way, swinging a fly ball deep to left field, and this one is goodbye baseball, a walk-off two-run home run for Mitch Garver, and the Mariners win it. They win it 2-1 over the Atlanta Braves. Garver with his fist in the air, rounding second, ready for the ovation, and greeting his teammates at home plate, a high five for Manny Ecta. Garver tosses his helmet, slams it down, being mobbed by his teammates. The Mariners with a walk-off win tonight over the Atlanta Braves.
Must be something about Bark at the Park night, man. Walk-off wins. Was it Leonis Martin back in the day?
It was.
Who walked
Leonis
it off?
Martin.
That was the game I went to with Wendell. He was no one more excited, as I'm sure you can imagine, than an aging French bulldog who wanted no part of being there. It's like, walk-off? Sure. Yeah, I'm into it.
Celebrating quite hard.
It's a heck of a game, man.
Yeah, remember the walk-off against the Braves in 2022? It was the Julio, the Eugenio home runs off Jansen.
Was that also Bark at the Park night?
tonight?
No, it was just like another walk-off against the Braves at home. Yes. I was just thinking that my first thought was
these two teams have played some really good games against each other, and it's funny because the Braves have really have been right there with the Dodgers, Astros, a couple other teams among the best in baseball for the last 3 or 4 years. That lineup is nuts. They got a heck of a pitching staff.
Yeah.
The bullpen is wonderful. It's a really well-built baseball team, kind of top to bottom, and you see it as you're battling against them last night. So I appreciated that, and watching someone like Bryce Miller carve through that lineup, oh my gosh, was that ever fun to watch. I mean, that was a thing of beauty. And it's funny, you know, we were talking yesterday and Brock was asking me to kind of, you know, rank these pitchers. I'm like, well, they're all ridiculous right now. It's just quality start after quality start. I had Miller as my fourth. And what did I say? Well, he's going to have trouble getting deep into the game against a really good lineup that knows how to, you know, kind of take him out. Well, guess what? He goes up against an unbelievable lineup last night and throws no-hit baseball for 6-plus innings, and it would have been longer if Dylan Moore could have made a play.
Strikes out 10.
He was ridiculous, and he's riding the fastball the whole time and manipulating the splitter. He was awesome. He really was tremendous last night. And guess what? Max Fried's also a really good pitcher, and he pitched in the World Series a couple of years ago, and he's, you know, a tough lefty who can do a few things with the baseball himself. And the Mariners didn't have a good offensive night. Heck, it was their second really bad offensive game in a row. But some games are like that. Some games are pitcher's duels, and they're fun. I like a good pitcher's duel. Frustrating at times, exciting at times. It comes down to the end, and when you have an opportunity to do it, you get it done. I thought actually the person who said it best was Bryce Miller, who was a quote machine, as it turns out. Bryce Miller said this last week, I'll say it again, is so much like a professional golfer. He just kind of tells you exactly how he feels. There's no real filter. There's no just a bunch of platitudes and cliches. He's like, yeah, in the fifth inning, I wasn't good. Sixth inning, I was better. My fastball was tremendous. Nobody's going to touch the slider. I had a little trouble with this.
And very matter of fact.
Like, very matter of fact.
Emotional, yeah.
It's just how golfers approach it. They're like, yeah, fourth hole, hit probably the best shot of my life. I was perfect. Unfortunately, the ball just took a bad bounce. I mean, what are you going to do? Next hole, yeah, it was awful. Just slice it into the woods. You can't do that. Double cross. I mean, like, they're very matter of fact. So I love the way he said this after the game.
Yeah, it's cool. It's, you know, he's a great pitcher. He's been around for a while, so he knows what he's doing. But it's fun, but I have fun whenever we got the lead. But if we got the lead all game, we can't hit a walk-off, so it's funny the way it's a fun game.
If you have a lead the whole time, you can't hit a walk-off.
Yep.
He's right.
And he could have easily been like, yeah, I really wish I could have had a lead, you know, really gone out there and got comfortable and find a groove. But he loved it the way it was.
I did too. Baseball, part of what makes baseball fun is that it pushes you to the brink. And I've said this, written this, talked about it any number of times on this show. Baseball will push you to the brink. It will drive you crazy. It will make you so 100% sure that you were seeing things the right way before completely turning it around and driving you insane. Sometimes you're convinced that your team's about to win and you get the rewrite in the final at bat. Sometimes it feels like there's no way your team's ever going to put up another run ever again. And then all of a sudden, your two new guys, both of whom have been incredibly disappointing to start their Mariner careers, single, home run, see you later. And by the way, the Garver at bat's a thing of beauty. I know that we don't generally break down every individual at bat here on this show, but let's talk through this for a moment. He gets up 3-0 in the count, right? This guy's struggling. All he wants to do is come through for his new team. He's struggling. He's up 3-0 in the count. You're probably hoping he's going to walk, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're down one. Nobody out in the ninth. Closer on the mound. If you're like me,
get a runner to second.
You're kind of hoping he's going to walk. Runner on second. Maybe then you're going to play small ball. I know it didn't work earlier, but maybe you're going to try to bunt him over. Hit wins the game. Fly ball ties it. You can play on. That's kind of what you're hoping. So you're probably frustrated when Minter, the pitcher in that situation, throws an absolutely perfect fastball on the edge for strike one. I mean, perfect. Outside corner, nothing you can do. Second pitch was, what, a slider or a cutter, something like that? Also exactly splitting the outside part of the outside corner. I mean, two 100% perfect pitches. He gets the call on both of them, which he deserved. But if you're like me, you're probably sitting there going,
Here we go again.
That was two chances for a walk, and this guy just threw unbelievable pitches on both of them. Nothing Garver could have done. Glad he didn't swing. He did the right thing. He couldn't have done anything with either of those pitches. You know what I wasn't expecting? The completely grooved pitch down the middle on 3-2 that Garver deposits into the left field seats. That's a heck of an at-bat. It's a heck of a game. I'm glad he didn't swing at either of those two pitches. Maybe he would have missed and everything would have been the same. Or maybe, you know, he rolls over on the slider. Or maybe he feebly just makes a little contact and you get a little pop-up on the fastball. Instead, he takes both pitches. They're both right on the corner. And he wins the game. And good on him and good on Polanco. Two guys that really needed it. Two guys that have been incredibly disappointing so far this year. I don't know if this is going to get them to take off and kind of become the guys they've been. But it can't hurt. I'll tell you that much. Having that kind of success certainly can't hurt. So fun game for the Mariners last night. They win. We got a lot more on them over the course of the morning. And a good day to talk to Jeff Passan. We will do that at 8:30. Okay. Hang on. We're going to come right back here with everything you need to know, including the Kraken finally making the move they probably needed to make like 2 years ago. It's next on Brock and Salk.
Need to know.
15 minutes past every hour with Brock and Salk.
Here's what you need to know. Up first.
Baseball games still 9 innings long, and the Mariners needed all 9 of them to find their offense last night. There wasn't much at T-Mobile through the first 8 as the Braves mustered just 1 run. The Mariners had nothing, but after they squandered a bases loaded situation in the 8th, Polanco singled, and Mitch Garver sent everyone home happy.
The stretch by Minter. Polanco a lead, and the lefties 3-2 on the way, swinging a fly ball deep to left field, and this one is goodbye baseball, a walk-off 2-run home run for Mitch Garver.
That's a heck of a win for the M. Scott Servais on the resilience of this team.
Yeah, guys know, you know, even I said the polo about the sixth inning, I said, great game tonight, isn't it? He laughed, he goes, it is a good game. You know, I just had a feeling, you know, if we could just, I thought it was going to happen in the 8th. I really did when we got the pinch hit, you know, at hits from Rojas and Raley, you know, top of lower order coming up. You know, they didn't come through. The other guys picked him up after that. And that's, you know, Polo's a veteran. He's been around leading off the 9th inning. Garver's not going to panic, even though they're not getting off to the starts they hope they got off to here. We have a lot of baseball to go, and they've proven themselves in this league, and it shows up late in games.
Yeah, there were some really interesting parts to this. Obviously, we've talked quite a bit about what Bryce Miller did. A fantastic, dominant performance. Didn't allow a hit until the 6th inning. Max Fried was matching him step for step. Didn't allow a hit himself. They're just going back and forth. And as I said, it looked like a pair of defensive plays were going to be the difference in this game. And then the two guys who've been struggling, Polanco and Garver, come through for Mitch. It was his first ever walk-off home run.
That was my first career walk-off in professional baseball, so walk-off home run. So that was pretty special for me, and in a time where things aren't going my way and I'm not feeling quite like myself, to be able to come through for the team in any way, shape, or form is like a huge W, so I was really happy for that.
Well, he certainly showed it, right? I loved the emotion on his face, the incredibly, like, almost... like he just didn't do anything. He just like sat there, stood there, and just took it all in for a moment. It wasn't an excited bat flip. It was more of a just drop it, look at his teammates, which you just gotta love. And you could see him, and I'm no great lip reader, but I think I can tell let's go when I see it.
Yeah.
And just a very simple let's go. And he runs around the bases, gets the celebration. Pretty cool moment, and another win for a Mariner team that just kind of keeps on rolling. They've won 4 series in a row, and an opportunity, if you can win either of the next 2 games against the Braves, to beat probably the best team in baseball, 2 out of 3 at home.
Here's the second thing you need to know.
Sorry, the Kraken are moving on. It was time. After 3 seasons behind the bench, they have fired Dave Hakstol, their first and only coach in the team history. It was the right decision. The team has regressed significantly this past year. The young players were not developing. The team played so poorly in the second half of the season and finally looked like they had given up. I have not been a big Dave Hakstol fan really since the beginning. Didn't love some of his... system, don't really love the personality, and I don't know that it was the right personality to try to fire up a fan base that is new to this game. He is so droll, he is so calm all the time, and in just sort of this like intensity that just doesn't rub people, I think, the right way. But I gotta give him credit. for especially last year, finding ways to keep that team engaged. Every time it looked like they were about to fall off a cliff, he dragged them back, and he gets some credit for that. Unfortunately for him, this year really went poorly, and his team regressed, as I said. The young players, to me, that's a big one. When Matty Beniers regresses the way he did this past year, you can't have it. And ultimately, the head coach was going to pay the price. But there's still a lot of questions now. What does a new coach do with this roster? Maybe a new voice is going to help. Maybe a new voice will give fans a reason to return this year, because a lot of those initial season ticket deals are going to be up. But there are serious questions about the talent on this team. And if the next coach doesn't have success, I would hope and assume that all eyes are going to turn to the architect of this thing, Ron Francis, who may be a Hall of Famer and one of the great players of all time and top five, I believe, in goal scoring of all time. But right now, he has not built a roster worthy of, you know, continued success.
Yeah,
so
it's not translating.
It's not translating at all. And he didn't have a tremendous amount of success in his first stint in Carolina, where he never made the playoffs. So there are going to be some real serious conversations. You're going to get one. You're going to get to make this move. But after that, I would think all eyes are going to turn to the GM's office.
Here's the third thing you need to know.
You're going to hear more from Brady Henderson here in a minute, but with the draft done, rookie minicamp set to go next week, Seahawks eventually are going to have some interesting roster decisions to make. A lot of D linemen and a lot of corners. Here's Brady on those D linemen.
They've got kind of a lot of guys there between your defensive ends and your defensive tackles. And the first thing that came to my mind when I saw them draft Byron Murphy is, okay, could you end up looking to trade one of these guys? And could that be Jaron Reed, who's 31 years old? Nothing about the way Jaron Reed played last year, but just from a salary cap and numbers standpoint, and a point that Brock made, which is that there is only one defensive tackle taken in the first round this year. So if other teams around the NFL didn't fill that need in the draft, you know, could they be looking to trade for a veteran like Jaron Reed?
Yeah, I would still be surprised if that happens. Not shocked, obviously, but surprised. I just found myself wondering whether or not Draymond Jones is going to end up playing a lot more on the edge. And then you've got the issues at cornerback, where you drafted two more guys to go with a unit that, at least on paper, seems to be full. So if I were some of those young corners, I might be a little concerned about where my job security is at heading into the season, which seems like a pretty good thing to me. All right, that is everything you need to know. Quarter past every hour here on the Brock and Salk Show. Talking a lot of Mariners this morning, talking a lot of Kraken, I think, over the course of the day, as they finally make that move with Dave Hackstall, which I think really was the right decision. And, of course, some football in there as well. So, if you missed any of Brady Henderson yesterday, you got to hear it, because it's a great sort of big picture look at the Seahawks draft, what they were accomplishing, and even more so, what happens next. Stick around. You'll hear it coming up on Brock and Salk.
This is Brock and Salk,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio, weekdays 6 to 10
on Seattle Sports and the Seattle Sports app.
Brock and Salk's Rewind is presented by Toyota of Kirkland.
The draft is now in the books, and so we get a pretty good sense of what this Seahawks roster will look like. Could they still make trades? Sure. We've seen things get done after the draft. We've seen things get done kind of in and around training camp as well. So it's not like this is now locked, but we got a pretty good sense, I would think, of what this team is going to look like, where they're going, and what it looks like short and long term. Brady Henderson's been covering all of it, Brock, for ESPN.com. Our buddy, the Hitman, he joins us right now. Hi, Brady. Hello. Good morning.
Michael, Brock, what's going on? Good morning. How you guys doing?
Did you sleep good Saturday night?
I sure did. Yes, I sure did. And I slept pretty well last night, too. Yeah, no, the draft is it's a grind. I mean, not nearly like it is for these NFL teams. But, it's a long weekend out there. But it's honestly one of the most fun things about the job is covering the draft. You're out there for 3 days, right next to the cafeteria, eating all the great NFL team food. And probably there's like the freshman 15, and there's the draft 3 or 4 for reporters. And so, yeah, I gotta do some cardio to work off some of the weight I gained, but it's a lot of fun.
What was the best thing you ate over the weekend?
Oh boy, they had a tomahawk there. I can't remember what night it was, but they had some really nice steak there and some salmon. So yeah, they spare no expense.
Good.
Well, yeah.
Well, really so good. Now that you're basically on their payroll, this should be an easy question. They've loaded you up with good food and, you know, kind of forced you to say nice things. What did you think about the draft overall?
Yeah, that said, I think they totally screwed up the draft. No, I'm kidding. I think they did a nice job. Now, I always go back to, like, you can end up looking very silly when you try to pass immediate judgment on a draft class, you know, 3-4 days after the fact. So, but with that qualifier in mind, I think you can boil this down to the simplest analysis, which is that their defense has been awful for the past few years, especially against the run. It's been the worst run defense over the last 2 years. And they got what is arguably the best defensive player in this draft, certainly the best defensive player on their board. And so, and this guy happens to be an excellent run defender, in addition to somebody who's got the juice to really be a difference maker in terms of a pass rusher as well. So, you typically, the majority of the judgment that you pass on a draft is going to be on the early round guys. And I'm still working through these day three picks to find out what they got there. But just based on the first pick that they made, the most important pick that they made, I think it's they did a really nice job there. I'm very interested to know what those offers look like to move back. Now I've been told that the four teams, that they were discussing trades with were Green Bay, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and Minnesota. Obviously Minnesota traded up, you know, right into Jacksonville spot right after that. And, you know, as Brock Heward made the good point that that trade offer did not look all that appealing.
That trade
was
stunk.
The offer that was on the table.
Trade stunk. Yeah. If the Seahawks had taken that deal, I would have panned it the next day as an absolute joke. That was a terrible trade that Jacksonville agreed to.
Yeah, yeah. I think if you're the Seahawks there, the only reason that you trade back is to pick up another pick on day two. So either a second or third rounder. And that trade that Jacksonville made did not include any day two picks this year. Now, if I'm curious what that offer from Green Bay would have looked like, because if you look at where Green Bay was, they were 25th. You just look at the draft value chart, and I realize that NFL teams don't use the ones that we can see on online. But if the value was similar, so the difference between those two picks, 25 and 16, is roughly the equivalent of a late second round pick. And I think Green Bay had pick number 58, so maybe you would have had to throw in another pick there to make that equitable. I wonder if Green Bay's offer included that pick, and I wonder if so, if the Seahawks were tempted to take that one. But you know, the other part of that equation when you're deciding whether or not to trade down, if you're the Seahawks, is okay, if you're moving all the way back to 25, who's going to be available there at 25 that you really like? I mean, so Graham Barton went 26. He's the interior lineman, offensive lineman from Duke. Darius Robinson went one pick after him. Aside from that, it's wide receivers and cornerbacks and another offensive tackle. So guys that I don't know if they really would have been all that excited about. Yeah. So I don't think you trade back just to trade back. And if Byron Murphy was there, he's your best defensive player on your board, then take him.
Brady, it felt like the most, it didn't feel like it was the most FaceTime that you guys had with Mike McDonald since his initial press conference and otherwise. What did you learn about the head coach over the course of 3 days?
Yeah, I think he's still kind of just getting used to being in this kind of spotlight. And, you know, somebody asked him at one point about the, you know, quote unquote redecorating that he did. And I don't know if he just was caught off guard by that because he was expecting to talk about the draft picks. But, you know, he kind of had to think about what he was going to say. And look, I think any coach in the NFL today or maybe in the next 10 years is not going to look as comfortable in that situation as Pete Carroll would. You know, Pete Carroll could, you know, talk his way out of anything and give a smooth answer, even if it wasn't always that substantial of an answer. But you know, I think McDonald is a first time guy. He's getting used to being in that kind of spotlight. And, you know, not that that was like a question that he was grilled on or anything, but it was, you know, that is kind of an awkward situation to have to talk about, given how passionate some fans are about what they did and even some former players. So, I'm sure you guys noticed the kind of fun video that the Seahawks posted on their website about, you know, it was McDonald and Schneider kind of walking through the building, and they were, you know, probably not coincidentally walking by a lot of these photos of these former players, just to make the point, I think, that, yeah, okay, they took the pictures down on that one wall, but if you walk throughout the building, there's pictures everywhere of, Carroll era players. So it's not like they completely scrubbed the VMAC of all those images.
We knew kind of going into this, we're talking to Brady Henderson, of course, of ESPN.com. Brady, we knew going in the Seahawks had some specific needs. Did they address them?
They certainly did. Yeah. Yeah, they did. I mean, if going into this draft, you would have said interior offensive line, defensive line, tight end, and linebacker, probably mostly in that order, but with interior offensive line being the first of those. And so they did that. I mean, those were their first four picks. The Tyrese Knight pick in the fourth round was interesting, and I'm very curious to see what kind of player he is, just because generally, for whatever this is worth, generally, if you just look at kind of where guys are projected to go among the draft analysts, it looked like he was more later in day three, like more in the sixth round. Those were a couple of mock drafts I saw. I also texted a scout from another team who said he thought fourth round was a little early for him. And I wonder if maybe they anticipated a run on linebackers right after that, which that didn't really happen until the fifth round. So, I'm curious about the thought process behind that pick and if they thought there was just no chance they were going to get him later. And if they didn't think the linebackers, the group of linebackers at their next pick, were all that special. And so, he's got okay speed, okay size. He's a very productive player. And as Mike McDonald said, the first thing that jumps out about him is his instincts. And they asked their linebackers to do a lot in that system. And they obviously feel like, they saw some things on tape to where, he could be a good fit for what they asked those guys to do. If your quote unquote reach is in the fourth round, if you draft a guy who was, you maybe had a fifth round grade on or a sixth round grade, that's not the end of the world. You just want to avoid doing that in the first and second and third rounds.
Okay. So selfishly here, who was the best interview of the eight of them? Who's going to be the best one on the Brock and Salk show in the months ahead leading up to training camp?
I think it's going to be Mike Jarrell. Yeah, their sixth round pick, the tackle they took from Finley. That guy was very entertaining. Now, some of the other guys, they were all, there was a few others. I think A.J. Barner, the first thing he says is, "I'm here to win championships." And he's just very confident and very eager to do whatever they ask him to do. And he talked about, "Hey, if you need me to catch 10 passes in a game, I'll do that. If you need me to block the C-gap, I'll do that." So he seems like a Jim Harbaugh, just, team centric guy. But yeah, Mike Jarrell seemed like I think he's going to be a fun interview. And I'm very curious to look at what his college film looked like, because if you're going to draft a guy from a small school like that, Division II Finley, and NFL teams will tell you this, that if you're projecting that guy in the NFL, you've got to see him routinely dominate players at that level to think that he can, handle what is going to be a massive jump in competition in the NFL. So I'm imagining that there's going to be some plays on tape that just look silly, that just look like, a high school senior playing against the freshman team or something crazy like that. But I do know that his interview was probably the one that stood out in terms of entertainment value.
Well, and I would think that's, a practice squad guy, right, where it's more of a long-term development plan. And I do wonder, there's, eight picks here. How many of these eight do you think make the team?
Well, certainly your first four. When you draft a guy in the fourth round, he's going to make your team unless something goes completely wrong. And then fifth rounders usually make the team as well, except – look, they were already pretty, pretty stacked at wide receiver, at cornerback. And that's how you know that, they weren't reaching for Nehemiah Pritchett or DJ James, because that was not a need at all. That was clearly a best player available with both those picks, with Pritchett at the very top of the fifth round and then with James in the sixth round. And so I think it's going to be hard for maybe both of those guys to make the team, just knowing that, you got a pretty solid group of cornerbacks already. Now, if Pritchett was drafted, later than what he was projected to go, then he might have a hard time sneaking him past waivers and getting him onto your practice squad. So I would probably say the first five guys. So Murphy, obviously Haynes, Knight, Barner, and then Pritchett. And then we'll see about the final three guys. But Mike Jarrell he's definitely a project when you talk about coming from that small school. But he's got some intriguing physical tools and physical skills.
So you bring up the cornerbacks there and saying that they were already kind of set at corner. They draft two. You draft one, okay, fine. That tells me that they like the value somewhere, whatever. But you draft two cornerbacks from the same system, from the same school, who were generally thought of fairly similarly. If you're a cornerback on this team, is this a message to any of them, specifically knowing that there was even some talk about them maybe taking a corner in the first round, which, again, I thought would have been a ridiculous idea, but probably not an accident that that got out there and was information that was available to people?
Yeah, I don't think they were ever taking a cornerback that early. I think that would have been a situation where if they just got stuck at a spot where they couldn't trade back, and you sort of had to, which would have not been ideal at all. But
well, let me be more direct. Is that a specific message to someone like Tariq Woolen?
Whether it was intentional or not, I think it could be. Yeah, I think every cornerback in that room, probably outside of Devin Witherspoon, has to be looking at that and saying, okay, you just drafted two guys. You know, yeah, day three picks, but you drafted two guys at what was already a pretty well stocked position. I would say that there is a message sent there, even if it was unintentional. I think Woolen has got to be one of the more fascinating guys on this roster. When you guys do your most, your countdown to the most intriguing Seahawks, I'm guessing he's going to be up there in the top two or three or four players, just because we all saw what happened last year, that he did not take that step. And I think there was a thought among some people in the building that, maybe read too many of his press clippings from his rookie season. And that was a guy that, success came upon him and fame came upon him like very quickly. He's a fifth round pick from a smaller school who only played cornerback for a season or two in college. And then all of a sudden he's a Pro Bowler. I think a lot of people, a lot of rookies in his situation might not have handled it all that well, but guess what? You have that down rookie season where you sort of maybe got benched a little bit towards the end of the season. And now they got a new head coach in, and now they draft two cornerbacks. And so I would think the new coaching staff would be enough to light whatever fire that needs to be lit under his rear end. But, now you add two draft picks at cornerback on top of that, then I would say you're probably going to get his best effort this season. And if he needed a wake-up call, I think he might have just gotten it.
Brady, you and I enjoy talking leading up to the draft and through the draft, but one area that you are super well versed in that I am not at all is your work with agents. And you heard John Schneider when he talked about Byron Murphy, that John had a long-standing relationship with Byron's agent, through the years, and I think really leans into these general managers do and these programs do, kind of lean into and trust certain agents and everything else. You and I were chatting, going into day two and some of the different picks and all the different agents that you talk to with these different players. How big of a role do those guys play at times in players landing certain spots, and how good of intel were they for you over the course of the draft?
Yeah, I think there are certain agents where GMs and just executives in general will have really strong agents, really strong relationships with, and they will trust those guys. I mean, an agent's job is to, do everything they can for their client to sell that client and to get him as drafted as highly as possible. And you don't always get the truth with those guys. And so I think it's not easy. You don't just have that kind of relationship with every one of those guys. There's got to be a lot of trust built up. And, the agent in question here is a guy named Ron Slavin, who I don't know if he's negotiated a big contract for a client with the Seahawks, but he's had a number of Seahawks clients over the years. He actually had Alden Smith a couple of years ago. And I wonder if that was part of the reason why the Seahawks decided to take that risk, which obviously was a big risk, knowing that Alden Smith's history. But I wonder if, they were comfortable taking that risk, knowing the agent and knowing, what they were getting into. And so, but Ron Slavin is a guy who's been around a long time. He's based out of Texas, so he ends up having a lot of guys from UT, a lot of guys from the state of Texas. And, the reason why his name came up with John Schneider is because Schneider said he didn't even talk to Byron Murphy during the pre-draft process, partly because he didn't think they'd have a chance to get him at 16, but he also was trying to play it coy and didn't want, sort of that interest to be out there. And when you're doing that, you're relying on the agent to give you really reliable information on what kind of person, what kind of player you're getting.
All right, so let's rewind the clock then to Thursday night when they make the selection of Byron Murphy. And we can talk through all these later round guys and maybe one or two of them will end up mattering. We'll find out. But the biggest name they took in this draft was the defensive tackle out of Texas. Why do you believe they went with Murphy over some of the other options that were available, including Troy Fautanu, Jared Ver, some of the other guys that were mentioned? Why did they go with Murphy?
Yeah, so I kind of think that their dream scenario would have been J.C. Latham falling to them at 16. Of course, that didn't happen. That dream died pretty early when he was taken 7 overall to Tennessee. He was the second tackle taken behind Joe Alt at number 5. You know, with Fautanu, look, when they were on the clock at 16 and he was there, I thought that was going to be the pick. You know, going back to a few days before the draft, there was a report out that there was some sort of knee issue that got flagged. And I wonder if this team has taken a little bit more of a cautious approach with guys with those injury issues in college. And you know, they didn't think that Daryl Taylor was going to miss his entire rookie season in 2020 when he was coming off that leg injury. And I just wonder, since then, it seems like they have been a little bit more cautious. And so, knowing that, I obviously picked Fautanu. He was my pick for the Seahawks in the mock draft that we did. But I just wonder if and I haven't heard this from anybody with the team directly. Like, this is me just kind of speculating based on the report that was out there, that I wonder if that gave them some pause with him. And look, you saw Pittsburgh take him at number 20. They also took Peyton Wilson in the second round, a guy with some very extensive and well-known injury issues in college. So I think the takeaway there is that when it comes to injuries with early round prospects, like, it's not a black and white thing. It comes down to whatever risk tolerance you have as an organization. And I just don't think the Seahawks have as much tolerance as certainly other teams like Pittsburgh clearly does.
Yeah, and Peyton Wilson has no ACL. So that was
ACL in one of his
picks. Yeah, ends up being a second round pick. AI, last two quick things for me. The story kind of seemed to die. We mentioned it on Friday, and I think it was James Palmer who had the report that the Seahawks were one of three teams to inquire about trading into the top 10 for Mike Penix. I think the team refuted that, or at least I had seen some semblance of that. Do you have any background, any intel on that conversation?
Yeah, I'm going to choose my words carefully here because I know the reporter who made that report. And I think he's a good reporter, but I can confidently say that that was not the case. In fact, I don't even think, and I said this before the draft, and I'm every bit as confident in it now as I was then, that I don't even think they would have taken Penix at 16. I just think that they liked him but didn't love him. And so, you know, look, the obvious connection there, I think, was such that, you know, when his coordinator is the same guy in Seattle and the offensive line coach, and he was right in their backyard. I think he was naturally, the Seahawks were naturally going to be used, you know, maybe as leverage in some way in terms of, you know, potential trade talks there of yeah, Seahawks really love him. Of course they do. Like, you know, his coordinator was there at UW and is now with the Seahawks. And so, the short version of the answer is I can say that that was not true.
And then last thing, they do have to free up some cap space, right? I mean, the cap space and the dollars and cents are pretty real. And with all of these now 8 draft picks, they've got to free up some money. How do you think they go about doing that?
For a cut,
Gino? I think one thing you're going to see – no, I don't, they're not going to cut Gino. But I think you're going to see them do is renegotiate the deals for Mike Jackson and John Rattigan. So they were restricted free agents, and the Seahawks used, I think, the $3 million and change tender – on both of those guys. What you see happen a lot with restricted free agents is teams will use, they will apply the tender, but really that's just a placeholder. And then they end up renegotiating that deal. And I think they would look at that and say, yeah, backup special teams linebacker is not going to get $3 million on the open market. So maybe you cut him and then sign him to something closer to the minimum salary. Mike Jackson's obviously started for them, but if he's their fourth cornerback, they're not going to pay him $3 million. So I think with at least one, if not both of those guys, you're going to see them bring that number down from $3 million. And then the other really interesting conversation here is, what do they do at defensive tackle with all of these players that they've got? I mean, they were not really – they were hurting for a difference maker at that spot, but they weren't hurting for numbers necessarily. And so all of a sudden you've got kind of a lot of guys there between your defensive ends and your defensive tackles. And the first thing that came to my mind when I saw them draft Byron Murphy is, okay, could you end up looking to trade one of these guys? And could that be Jaren Reed, who's 31 years old? Nothing about the way Jaren Reed played last year or you know, handled himself in the locker room would say, yeah, he's a guy you need to trade. But just from a salary cap and numbers standpoint, you know, he's going to make $5 million this year. So you could get some salary relief maybe there. And a point that Brock made, which was a good one, which is that there is only one defensive tackle taken in the first round this year. That kind of goes to show there was not a whole lot of great options in the draft in terms of defensive tackles. If other teams around the NFL didn't fill that need in the draft because there weren't that many guys available, you know, could they be looking to trade for a veteran like Jaren Reed? I think that would seem more likely than Draymond Jones, just because like the Jones salary is the contract is going to be harder to trade, and he's a younger guy and he offers you more versatility on your defensive line. So I would keep an eye on Jaren Reed. I don't have any information saying that they're looking to trade him. In fact, I ran that by somebody with the team and they said, no, that this person thought that Mike McDonald would like having all those options, but you got to create some cap space and you may have to create some room in what is a pretty crowded position.
I still wonder whether we're going to see a little more Draymond Jones on the outside and the edge, like we did at times last year. And, you know, if that's one of the reasons they feel a little bit more confident in that position, then maybe some others do, especially in rundown. So we'll see. Brady, great stuff. I'm excited about the steak. It sounded like it was pretty good.
The ribeye?
It was quite good.
Yeah, it was good. That sounds pretty good.
Yeah, I'm going to go for a run after this just to work off some of the calories.
All right, go make that happen. Yeah.
And you joined Bob Condotta with that. Some of the other guys, really cool, really good. It's going to be nice.
How's your hamstring? Feeling okay?
Yeah. Mine's fine. I heard yours is not feeling that great.
No, it's not that great. Yeah, it's kind of
you got
to. Thank you, Brady.
Right now?
Not at the moment. Right. Yeah, this just isn't a great spot for the eyes. It'll be on later, I promise. Goodbye, Brady. There goes Brady Henderson, our friend and confidant from ESPN.com.
Yeah, I would say the hamstring is not really improving the way I would like it to. It had some like market improvement in the first couple days.
Plateauing.
And now we sort of hit a plateau. Yeah. And it definitely still hurts, and I would like that to stop. So
I don't think it's the kind of thing it's like, 48 hours and you're good.
No?
I don't think that's how that works. How,
like a week?
I'm guessing several.
I think I have two concerns. One, now other parts of my leg hurt. My groin, my calf, my hip, they all kind of hurt also.
Like work harder because that
And then also I'm concerned that I hurt the hamstring in two different places, like kind of the bottom of the muscle and the top of the muscle. So
you're a mess.
Yeah. Anyway, all right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, my favorite grasshopper, Brock, will be in and we'll chat about the Mariners' walk-off win last night. Was it always destined to be? Was this a great baseball game? Stick around. It's next on Brock and Salk.